Our world is built with stories.
Sometimes these stories cause suffering by pulling us apart from ourselves and each other.
The Liturgist podcast helps people love more and suffer less by pulling apart the stories that pull us apart.
Today's story, I'll be happy if.
All right, so we've got Pete Rollins back on the podcast. One of my favorites and one of our crowd favorites. Welcome back, Pete.
Oh, thank you. You're one of my favorites, just in general.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm excited about hearing your music, by the way. Can I say you're doing new stuff?
Thank you.
I'm very excited to hear it.
I can't wait to play it for you. Thank you.
I'm just saying that publicly, so you have to let me hear it. Because now I've said it to
now it's out there.
Yeah, your audience.
And I've agreed. So.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. So last time we talked about scapegoating and how that mechanism of other people being the problem. And there's like another side of the coin, which is, you know, that I will be happy if. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times we have this externalized problems, but we also attach on the other side of things, attach our joy, our happiness to some external thing as well, as though if we only could have this, accomplish this, have this relationship, get that promotion, whatever the thing is, then all my internal problems will be solved.
Yes. Yeah.
So what can we, where do you want to start off with that? I know you've done a lot of work with that idea. And how do you see that? Maybe we could start from where we were last time with how is that related to the scapegoat mechanism?
Absolutely. Because the scapegoat mechanism is all about the idea that there is a sense of a lack and you get someone else to carry it. So sin traditionally just means lack. Mm-hmm. And so whenever the scapegoat is the one who carries the sin of the community, which means they carry the lack of the community. And this idea of lack is key. I mean, this is why I actually really like the language as from a philosophical perspective of original sin. Because if you strip away the confessional religious dimension of it, what it means is original lack. And in the kind of philosophy that I'm interested in, the philosophy of Hegel and Lacan, there is this notion that there is a sense of lack that is part of being human. It's not just that we have a lack. It's original. It's part of who we are. To be a self is to know that you're not something else. So there's an inside world. There's an outside world. There's a me. There's a you. So there's something about subjectivity that involves a kind of lack. And we're always trying to get rid of it. And there's lots of people who are promising that they can get rid of it. But perhaps the challenge is to learn how to live with it and enjoy it, right? So often when we're in life, we're looking for that thing, money, fame, looks, whatever it is, something that will fill the lack, that will take it away, that will make us whole and complete. And I think that's the religious promise par excellence, is the promise that if you do the right yoga moves, if you take the right drugs, if you have the right tantric sex, if you worship the right God, if you if you have a child, mm-hmm. if you don't have a child, whatever it is, the thing that is promised that will make you whole, that is the that's kind of the religious movement. And a lot of my work is about exploring what can be called religionless religion, which is a salvation from the need to find that salvation. So we could jump into that. I mean, that's a lot.
Let's jump in. I love it.
Yeah. So, I mean, we could talk a little bit about where this lack comes from.
Yeah.
You know, because nothing mystical about it for someone like Lacan. It's simply that there's a certain point around the age of 3 months, 3 to 18 months, where the infant begins to realize that they are a self. You begin to gain a selfhood. And with that notion of selfhood, there is the notion that you're not your mother. You're not your brother or your sister, right? So
your environment.
You're kind of starting to differentiate. Yeah. And that differentiation, by the way, it doesn't always occur. In psychosis, a person, that differentiation is always very fragile or very fragmented in schizophrenia or whatever. But for the typical neurotic, they feel differentiated from the world. And then they feel that they've lost something. You feel, oh my goodness, I lost this oceanic oneness. I lost this this oceanic experience of being one with everything. But the weird thing is you didn't lose it because you are the result of not having it. So the I is, in a sense, is the eruption of lack into the world. It's the eruption of kind of you being apart from things. But then that means you're marked with this for the rest of your life. You're marked with this feeling of loss. I lost something. And that is something that we can always kind of want to get back. And there's basically two types of religion that answer this. There's religions of hedonism and religions of nihilism. So religions of hedonism say you can fill this lack, right? So whether it's through money, sex, drugs, religion. And religions of nihilism are the only way to escape it is to get rid of your desire, to have no desire, to kind of embrace the lack, the negative. And I think these are both false solutions to the problem. There's a third type of religion, and it's the religion of the absurd. And this is where you basically embrace your dissatisfaction. And you kind of like, I use an example of my own work, right? So I do a thing called parotheology. Now, what is parotheology? Well, it's nothing. It doesn't exist. It's just a word that was thought up by a friend of mine when we were doing these events in Belfast. But I constantly try to define what it is. So I do lots of courses. I write books. And every time I do a book or do a course, I miss it. I go like, I didn't really define it. I fail to get it. But those repeated failures actually start to create it. So as I repeatedly fail to define what this amorphous thing is, it starts to take shape. And then what I do is I start to enjoy my failure. I enjoy the constant failure to define what it is. And there is where I find a certain joy within life. So that's the challenge, is we think we'd be happy if we get the thing that will make us whole and complete, but we're not. When we get it, we realize it doesn't work. Or we think we'd be happy if we can just, you know, give up and have no desire, but that's just depression. What we have to learn is, how do we enjoy what we don't have? Well, how do we enjoy, how do we revolve our lives around some sort of project that we always fail to get, but that in that failure generates something positive?
I love all that. That was, I mean, that's so much of my non-dual understanding, is the wrong word, but yeah, approach.
Tell me a bit about that.
Philosophy and religion. That, so in non-dual thought, you are the wholeness of the all, which is contradiction, which is yin and yang. And there is this existential wound of self that is self. And trying to make that heal only can be done by a self. So it's just reinforcing its own wound. By trying to heal it, you're still at odds with what is. The irony and like the paradox at the heart of it, and I think what at the heart of what Jesus was saying of like, you have to die to live, is just surrendering to that the way that it is. Surrendering to the wound being part of the all, it does take away the sting.
Yeah, it's interesting you're saying that, because most philosophy, here we're talking philosophy now, this is my joy, is exploring, you know, in a way, a non-dualist type of thought. So in so much philosophy, there is a question of, you know, how do you reconcile thought and being, or mind and matter, or materialism and idealism? So these are realities. There's thought and there's being. How do they interact with each other? Do they interact with each other, et cetera, et cetera? And interestingly, Hegel, who I think was one of the greatest philosophers, he had a reading of Christianity that was fascinating. He had a philosophy that ultimately, it's very complicated philosophy, but he basically showed that, he said, life is a series of contradictions. What happens is, even in general life, we encounter a problem, we encounter a contradiction or a deadlock, some problem in mathematics or some problem in our life, and we try to resolve it. And what Hegel basically shows is that as we resolve problems, we find deeper problems. And we find deeper and deeper problems. And for him, the evolution of human society, but also the evolution of the entire universe, is this deepening of contradiction. So the movement from nothing into being, from being into life, from life into consciousness, from consciousness into self-consciousness, right, which are these massive moments in the movement of the universe, Hegel shows that they are a deepening of contradiction, playing out in deeper and deeper ways. Mm-hmm. And then what Hegel basically tries to show is that eventually we get to the point where we realize that contradiction is in the heart of reality itself. Mm. Now, just to make it concrete for a second, because I think that what we've seen in the last 300 or 400 years has been the development of this idea. So within mathematics, for example, you have Gödel, who was a great mathematician, and he showed that it's fascinating. He basically showed that if mathematics attempts to be all-encompassing, it falls into contradiction, mm-hmm. right? Now, in physics, Niels Bohr showed that at a quantum level, we enter into wave-particle duality and mm-hmm. superpositioning. There's other examples. Oh, yeah, well, Darwin showed that life, biological life, is a conflict of adaptation and reproduction. And all of these moments, and there you can see them in various disciplines, there's just three as an example. Mm-hmm. Contradiction becomes part of reality itself. So, for example, before Gödel, the notion is that mathematics, any contradictions you find in mathematics are contingent. They're not inherently part of mathematics. Mm-hmm. You can get rid of them. But with Gödel, you enter into this possibility, and I don't think even he realized, is that, no, at its deepest level, mathematics has contradiction built into its heart. Mm. With physics, again, before quantum mechanics, even Einstein didn't go this far. He opened the door but didn't walk through it. Before Einstein, it was like the contradictions of the physical world were contingent. And once we know enough, we could get rid of them. Mm. Then with quantum mechanics, the contradiction becomes hard-baked into reality itself. Mm. So in the same way, what Hegel is saying is we eventually get to the point where we realize that there is a contradiction in reality itself. And when we encounter that, he calls this absolute knowledge. And his reading of Christianity, this is fascinating. The reason why he liked Christianity was he said that in religions generally, God is lacks the lack. God is whole and complete. But in Christianity on the cross, Christ cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? In other words, you realize that God has a lack. God experiences a lack of God, right? And this, for Hegel, is a way in which individuals can experience that at the heart of reality, the heart of the absolute, is a type of lack. And he calls this the reconciliation of unity and difference. Mm-hmm. So in one sense, it's a whole, but it's a whole with a whole, H-O-L-E. I find it interesting when you talk about that your non-dualistic thinking has a place for a type of deadlock. And I like that because I was worried for you for a while. So I like that I hear that, because I think that's the ultimate insight, is that we realize that there's a deadlock in reality itself. But when we encounter that, and oh, by the way, can I just talk one?
Please.
One, oh, sorry.
Okay. I'm fully enjoying this.
All right. Well, so if you look at development of a kid, right, there's two things that happen. You can call them alienation and separation. And alienation is the point when you realize that you're separate from your parents. We already talked about that, and that's where you experience the lack, right? You experience this lack and you're no longer one with your parents. And what kids try and do is they try to get back to the oneness. They want to be everything to their parent. That's the Oedipus complex, right? Kill the father, be back with the womb of the mother. And, you know, we see children always trying to undermine the paternal figure, which, you know, whenever kids always ask these questions, why is the sky blue and why is that? And people think they're very inquisitive, but often it's because what they want to do is they want to get their parent to eventually say, I don't know, expose their impotence, because we have to expose the impotence of our parents, right? So, but the child is also wanting to, you know, be everything for the other. And that's a perverse structure, actually. As a perverse structure is, as an adult, you want to be everything to the other. But anyway, so separation, that's alienation. You're alienated from the people around you. But then something else happens for Lacan, and it can be described as redoubled alienation. And what that means is, it's where you realize that you can't fulfill your parents, you can't be one with them, because they can't be one with themselves. You can't fulfill the desire of your mother or father, because they don't even know what they desire, because their desire is in flux, because they are not at one with themselves. And at this point, you then become free. And this is called separation. And so this is similar to what Hegel is saying about Christ, is at first you feel yourself separate from the absolute or God or whatever you want to call it, and you want to get that oneness, and you'll do anything, and you sing all the songs and you say all the prayers or whatever it is. But then once you realize that you can't be one with the absolute, because the absolute is not at one with itself, then you become comfortable with your own not at oneness. You become comfortable with your own divided self, and yeah, that is salvation. That's the moment, that's called the epoch of the Holy Ghost, when you are able to live in community without some sort of big other you're trying to satisfy and maintain. You know, the absolute is now in the community of people living responsibly with one another. There's a lot in that, sorry.
No, yeah, that's beautiful. So where it comes back for me to, like, the spiritual, like when I hear Jesus talk or the Buddha, that it's not a dissolution of the self completely, as far as, like, that there is no sense of self anymore, but it is, the sense of self does get engulfed into a bigger isness, where the wound is no longer identified with, and so it no longer has power. And that, in my experience, that happened in 2016 for me, this, like, awakening moment of seeing the self constriction, of seeing the self wound, asking myself, who's seeing this? Who is the seer, other than just the universe, other than all the all that is seeing within itself these little constrictions and these contradictions? And so the all has the contradictions in it, has the wounds in it. But maybe I just went crazy.
Yeah, that'd be fun to talk about. Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
I mean, okay. But that's what I hear when I hear in Jesus talk about those things. I hear from that place of I am-ness.
Yeah. Well, see, it's interesting, like, because, yeah, I like that you're taking, you're going from it from a more spiritual perspective, and I like that, because what I'm doing then is I want to kind of then ground it in a very material way as well, just in mathematics and in physics and in biology.
It's all just words.
Yeah. But also the unconscious is the name in psychoanalysis for this kind of contradiction in reality. Because Jung, he's not a psychoanalyst, so Jung goes a different direction. But the Freudian insight is that the unconscious is simply the name, really, for a type of imbalance within us, a type of not at oneness of ourselves. And so, you know, you can experience this in a spiritual way, and also make sense of it in terms of politics and in terms of, so for example, in political sense, there's a book I really like called by a guy called Todd McGowan, The title is a terribly boring title called Emancipation After Hegel. But it's a very good book in which he argues that the left, and this is why progressivism went wrong, is that the left took Hegel's work, but they left his religious stuff behind. So with Feuerbach and then through Marx and then today, they ditched Hegel's work on religion and on the state. But actually that Hegel's work on religion, far from being kind of some sort of weird, like, why is he into Christianity? Like, he's one of the smartest people in the world. Like, it's going out, oh, there's actually something really interesting that he's seen in it. And it's this idea that if we don't embrace the idea that there is contradiction in life, we will end up thinking that we can be whole and complete. Then we will end up having a purity culture. Then we will end up scapegoating. Then we will end up creating enemies. And then we will basically become the evil that we are trying to fight.
Mm.
And so it's all interconnected, you know. So this notion of this deadlock in the one, this wound that is within the one, is not just, it is a spiritual thing, but it's actually also got real political and mathematical and scientific import.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. How does that bring us back to the I will be happy if?
Yeah.
Because we've kind of taken a big, long rabbit trail around, but it is, there is this sort of existential wound that is the self. It's funny, I do these little sessions sometimes with people where we look at like the nature of the self, and one of the exercises we do in it is go through the body and like, can you find yourself in your body?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in that exercise, people will often go to places that are wounded.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be like, right here, my ribs, I had a broken rib and it hurts. And that feels more like me than the rest of their body. They like feel that wound as themselves more, which is like the self is a wound.
That's very interesting because Hegel has the phrase, the spirit is a bone. And what he means by that is basically that when he says spirit is a bone, it's almost like saying that, Or let's put it in a Freudian way, the way you set up, which is perfect, it was very, very good, is that we might feel like a broken rib, or we feel we've got hives, or we've got an itchy skin, or we've got like certain kind of like skin problems. And that's like a bone, that's like out there objective. It's on your skin, it's not subjective. But actually, it's where we inhabit. That is saying something about us more than we know.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, part of what we're trying to do is subjectively interpolate ourselves into our objective symptoms, to find ourselves in our wounds and to find ourselves in our symptoms. And that process is a very powerful process. So I think that's what they do in psychoanalysis is what you're doing in your retreat when you're asking people to find themselves and they're identifying themselves in physical dimensions of their body.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very powerful experience because those parts of our body tell us who we are. They speak truth. They speak something. Yeah.
And so we feel these wounds. We feel this, our sense of self being some of the walls of who we are being our wounds themselves. Mm-hmm. And then we look outside of ourselves for healing, for salvation, for the thing that will make me happy, the thing that will save me. Why is that? What are we missing when we do that?
Yeah. And this thing, by the way, there's a name for it. Lacan gave it a name. He called it objet putia. Small object A, but they don't translate it. They usually say objet putia, and I'll call it object A. Object A is the name for the thing that you think will heal you. It's the name for the object it is, whatever relationship it is, whatever it is, it's object A. And Lacan kind of like gave a really good explanation for where this comes into existence. Why do we believe in object A? One way of thinking about it is using a Freudian language, where he talks about we have a desire for pleasure, the pleasure principle. I want to be able to climb trees. I want to eat chocolate. I want to play games and win games. And then the reality principle is what gets in the way. I can't eat everything I want because my mum won't let me. I can't climb all the trees I want because my body won't let me. And I can't win all the games that I want because my friends won't let me. And when we encounter this conflict between the reality principle and the pleasure principle, we fantasize that if only we got rid of the reality principle, we could be happy, right? Get rid of reality principle, we get everything we want, it would be fantastic. But of course, the problem is, it's the reality principle that makes things pleasurable. If you just simply got everything you wanted without any struggle or any opposition, you wouldn't enjoy it. If you could just climb Mount Everest with a thought, it wouldn't be fun to mm-hmm. do, right? Mm-hmm. Part of the fun is training, buying the equipment mm-hmm. and the danger. And I've seen this. I know some mega rich people who have grown up mega rich, and melancholy sets in mm-hmm. because there is to a certain extent they can have whatever they want when they want it. The result is not happiness, it's mm-hmm. melancholy. Mm-hmm. With that, the sadness of getting what you want. Object A is what is basically, think of it like almost like a black hole or this void in us that certain objects fill. Mm-hmm. And then we think if we could get them, we'd be happy. And Zizek has a beautiful analogy of what Object A is. He says it's similar to what young Earth creationists think of in terms of fossils. Because during the time of Darwin, supposedly one of his friends who was a young Earth creationist, liked everything Darwin was saying, and Darwin was like, listen, what do you think of all these fossils that I find? And he goes, yeah, no, I admit you find these fossils and they look old, but he says God created the world to look old, mm-hmm. right? So he put those fossils in mm-hmm. there, right? And Zizek says this is the perfect analogy for Object A, is these are fossils. Whenever I get the $1 million that I think will make me happy, I'm left with a fossil of Object A, but it's a fossil of something that never existed because Object A doesn't exist. Object A, all you get are the fossils of something that never even existed. Mm. And we need to somehow kind of, it needs to be revealed to us. And it's difficult to do that Object A doesn't exist and that we will destroy ourselves in the pursuit of it. But even more weird is we would prefer not to get Object A and for it still to exist than to realize it doesn't exist. Mm. So René Girard, a philosopher, anthropologist, said once, he said, imagine this guy in a field. It's a rocky field and he's told that under one of the rocks there's a treasure. Eventually, if he lifts enough rocks and doesn't find any treasure, Girard says he will find a rock so heavy that he cannot lift it. In other words, he wants to find a rock so heavy he can't lift it, so he can still maintain the fantasy that if he could lift it, underneath there would be some treasure. Right? Mm-hmm. What's more traumatic than not getting Object mm-hmm. A is realizing it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And yet, realizing it doesn't exist is what frees us. Because the goth is the ultimate melancholy. Like the goth is the ultimate person who, you think goths are realistic, right? Because they're depressed and they see through the silliness of life. But no, they're romantics. They so believe that there is something and someone, I don't know, Dracula or whatever, who's a romantic hero and that they don't have, which makes them melancholy. If you're not depressed enough, right? Because you still believe the Object A is out there. Mm. You have to redouble the depression. You have to get to the point where you go, it's not just that I don't have Object A. Object A isn't there. And then you can be free to experience joy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because joy means the pleasure of not getting what you want, basically.
I love hearing it in this different language, because this is I'm used to more spiritual language with this kind of stuff.
Oh yeah.
But to me, this is Taoism, this is Buddhism, this is non-duality. It's that beauty of the cross. It's the beauty of life in death.
Yeah.
Of letting go of your life and what you think you need to be happy. Letting go of salvation and finding that you are salvation because you are.
Yeah.
You just are the in a weird way, like you are the thing that you've been looking for.
Yeah, I'd be very interested because I wonder whether, like, I'll have to look into more about what you're doing, because, you know, there might be some kind of interesting resonances, yeah, between what we're doing. Yeah, because this idea of joy, for example, is very non-dualistic. Like, joy, C.S. Lewis had a great definition of joy where he said that basically it was an aroma of heaven, right? He talked about these moments of joy when he experienced this aroma of this kind of utopia. But what's interesting about that is he was experiencing pleasure of not having, because he didn't have the utopia. He didn't have the heaven, right? He kept fantasizing about it, but the joy was this experience of pleasure in not having. And if you think about a kid at Christmas, there's pleasure, which is when he gets the Christmas presents, right? Opens the Christmas presents. And there's enjoyment, which is when she's like excited about Christmas coming, right? The problem is sometimes we can't enjoy our enjoyment. So the little kid is wetting themselves. They're having temper tantrums. They're so excited about Christmas coming. But eventually then they open the present. There's a momentary pleasure, but actually all the fun is in the enjoyment, which is the not having the present, the waiting for the present, mm-hmm. the expectation of the present. And in a similar way, life has moments of pleasure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But actually what can be sustained is joy. And I mentioned it earlier with my own project, my own work, is that's joy, because with moments of pleasure is maybe when I publish a book. And I go, oh, yeah, I think I nailed something there, right? And that's momentary. That lasts for virtually no amount of time. Like, actually, I get very little pleasure from publishing or anything. But there's probably a moment where you get the book through the post and you go, oh, that's nice. But the enjoyment is the frustration of writing it. And pursuing it and then going, no, I'm going to have to write it again. I'm going to have to rewrite that because it was rubbish, you know, and writing a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth book. And that is a weird form of pleasure in not getting. It's a bringing together of two seemingly opposite things.
Yeah. You know, let's say I've got my finger hurts. I've hurt my finger. I can experience that as suffering if I don't want it to be like that. And I have this idea of, well, I should be feeling. I've had healthy fingers before that aren't hurting. And I'm like, God, I wish I had fingers like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you could also theoretically just imagine, use your imagination to be somebody who's never had feeling in their hands. And all of a sudden they have a feeling. And even if it's painful, that might be an absolute delight. Oh my God, I can feel with my finger.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a joy. Yes. To experience pain.
Yes. Well, that's funny. Like, Hegel talks about this, and it sounds crazy at first. Exactly what you're saying in a philosophical way is that pain is the contradiction of life. Because basically life is between being and nothingness. Being is pure stuff, and nothingness is pure lack of stuff, right? And becoming is the contradiction. Becoming is kind of like where we are moving towards death, but we're also, you know, we can become healthier and so pain is basically the expression of that contradiction.
Yeah.
So there's even growing pains when you think of, I remember when I was growing and the difficulties in my legs and the pains in my bones and it's not, because someone might hear this and go, this is a glorification of pain. But it's something deeper. It's actually saying that life cannot exist without some level of pain. Mm-hmm. That either too much pain...
And joy can't exist without some level of pain.
Yeah. And like too much pain is, and you know, you die. And too little pain, and there would be no subjectivity, no self. So there is this interesting place of... That life has a certain amount of pain within it.
It's just it brings it back to my how I'm experiencing the world, how I'm experiencing my life doesn't happen objectively. It doesn't happen out there. It happens here and now, and it happens through this body. It happens through this subjectivity, through these wounds. Through the stories that I'm telling. And so when I'm tempted to either go, they're the problem or this is the solution, I can be invited closer into the actual thing that's going on, which is happening in me, and how am I perceiving and reacting to, and how are my desires interacting with what's happening? Yeah. And I think the closer that you always bring it back there, where you bring it back to yourself, you can avoid some of the traps and illusions that of the rainbow, or the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that doesn't exist. You just forever be chasing your own tail, or on the other side of things, the trying to solve a problem out there that's not going to help you anyway.
And at the highest level of all this, when you get to, you know, level 132 or whatever, it's, we realize we are the wound of the universe. You know, like, we, it's not so much that even that we have contradictions, we are the contradiction. Yeah. And at a very deep level, you know, there are the traumas that happen to us in life, and we can do stuff about them. And what we want to do is we want to minimize the traumas that happen to people in life. But there is the trauma that is life, and we all share in that trauma. That there are the wounds that we sustain, and there is the wound that we are. And the wounds that we sustain, we can create a better life for people where we sustain less wounds. But we ultimately, if we do enough work, we will come to see the realization that we are the wound of the universe, which means we are the kind of the lack, the we are the eruption. Basically, we are the universe seeing itself and hearing itself and speaking itself. Mm-hmm. And so in order for that to happen, there needs to be these cuts, like Swiss cheese.
Yes.
These cuts. And we are the cuts. And it's very difficult to get your head around at first, but it's funny because in various areas, like, so in politics, I think it's called democracy. In psychoanalysis, it's called the cure. In philosophy, it's called absolute knowing. And in Christianity, I think it's called salvation. They're all kind of similar, which is the moment in which you realize that you're able to embrace the contradiction and the lack that you are. You're able to make peace with that lack. And in doing so, you stop scapegoating, you stop pursuing lost objects, and you're able to be.
What else could notice the wound but just being?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And being itself doesn't have anything to change about itself. It just is, right?
Yeah.
And so being recognizes the wound within itself, and being is perfectly fine all of the time.
This is where I'm more pessimistic. This is good. This is why we're able to talk. Is it's like, I almost want to say, like, this is why being is not well all the time, but that's why it is. Like, that's, there's this weird, the reason why anything exists at all is because of this oscillation in being. So being is kind of like reality. Everything we see, as I say, being out of nothingness, life out of being, consciousness out of life, self-consciousness out of consciousness. These are all the eruptions of deadlocks and contradictions resolving themselves and going deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah, what do you think about I've got this kind of notion that I don't know if it's true. It seems true to me. I'm curious what you think. That anything, as soon as you start getting close to something, saying something that is like pretty good, pretty true, you can say the opposite and it's also true.
Oh yeah, this is oh, you're so right. This is why I'm against wisdom, and this is why I hate Instagram, actually. Here's an example. Shizek does this, but I'll do a different, I don't know what he does, but I'll do a different one. But if I say to you, you know, don't get caught up in the everydayness of life, you know, meditate on the infinity of space and time, and they will lift you out of the mundane concerns of the world. Oh, wow. Then if I say to you, you know, the true joy of life is in the little momentary material things, the smile of a stranger, the kiss of a lover, the embrace of a friend. Don't get caught up in the eternal and the infinite. Find joy and meaning totally. In the moment. And then I can add another one, and I can go, you know, the pursuit of a meaningful life is itself the problem, the pursuit of, mm-hmm. of meaning is what makes us so unhappy and unfulfilled. Just give up the pursuit of either the eternal or the infinite little tiny moments. Forget mm-hmm. both of them and simply be. Or I can say it is the pursuit of meaning that makes our life meaningful, whether it's in the pursuit of the eternal or yeah. in the pursuit of the momentary. So, yeah. And so there's four, all different, and you say them in the
opposites
same kind of like,
and all equally true.
Yeah, and all in the same voice. So this is why, I mean, I'm very anti-wisdom, but I see this as funny on Instagram. I did think of setting up a Twitter account once that had wisdom sayings where each saying, just the next one contradicted it. The next one contradicted it. But
but when what you said, like, I like wisdom for that. Like, they all are valuable from certain vantage points at certain.
Well, yeah, the only thing being, here's my devil's advocate on this, because I can say, oh, you know, they all could be useful. But one is they tell you just more about yourself. So, you know, like whichever one you like. Like I said, when someone gives you advice, they're telling you about themselves. It's hilarious. 9 times out of 10, they're saying what they would like to do. So, oh, you should break up with them. Okay, what are you saying to yourself? the other thing is, the thing I like about philosophy is, in one way, it's like it tries to actually say something that does work universally at all. Like it tries to get to an insight that's right. And so I do kind of like that. Also, I do see figures like Jesus as anti-wisdom and anti-ethical. Because this is the one thing that progressives say about Jesus. They go like, regardless of anything else, the one thing we can say about him is he's ethical and he was wise. But Soren Kierkegaard, when he's turning in his grave, he says, no, the whole point is Jesus, like, the wisdom, it's not wisdom tradition. You take Abraham and Isaac, for example, that's nuts. If anybody ever says to you, I want to go and kill my kid, it's like, you know, but the whole Abrahamic faith is based on this, and Jesus is always overturning wisdom and also acting yeah. unethically. So, and then Kierkegaard does a whole, like, builds a whole existential philosophy on that very insight. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, but I think that it's built into it. Like, there's, I've heard it somewhere, and I don't know if this is true to the Jewish understanding of these books, but that there's sort of a progression, like Proverbs would be more of like for a young person, than Ecclesiastes, as you kind of deconstruct the constructs of Proverbs, and then ultimately Song of Songs
yeah.
being sort of union. So you have like this construct, deconstruct, union, progression to wisdom, thoughts, whatever, but baked in to the wisdom, to these sayings that can be helpful at one point or another in your life, and you see the opposite is also true.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the reasons why I like the Bible. It's funny because there's people who believe in the, you know, you'll know a thing called inerrancy, and it's, but actually one of the beautiful things about the text is that it's full of contradictions. You know, God hears everything, but God is deaf. God is a peacemaker, but God is a warrior. Proverbs, where one proverb completely contradicts another, or four gospels where literally, that, you know, Jesus clears the temple is the first thing in one gospel and it's the last thing in another mm-hmm. gospel. And the point being, not that these contradictions were actually often embraced by the writers themselves, which is, of course, part of the idea of truth, if truth is contradiction, that's actually part of one of the things I like about the text. As you say, like Proverbs, you can't read Proverbs without seeing it's fundamentally in conflict with itself. Yeah. And that's, and yeah, that's the meaning yeah. of it. Like, yeah. That's actually what the writers are doing. They're yeah. actually bringing you into a deep insight there. Yeah. So, and even the fact there's four gospels that don't fit. Like, there was what was the name of the early church father? Tertian? No, that's a book company. But similar to that. But he tried to make one gospel, put them all into one, and he was condemned as a heretic. Wow. And I'm always surprised that evangelicals don't try to do that. But because I think deep down they know that actually the truth is in the contradiction. Like, is in the fact that it's four different conflictual testimonies make something interesting. That's actually one of the interesting things about it. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Love it. Okay, so as far as the story, the myth, I will be happy if, are we stamping that not true?
Oh yes, I would be happy with, yes. The trick is to enjoy your lack of enjoyment. For neither go for the religions of nihilism or the religions of hedonism. It's the religion of the absurd, Kierkegaard's religion of the absurd, which is the highest and the lowest form, the having and not having are there. I mean, this is what the cross is like. God dying is actually an absurd claim. It's an absurdist claim. We should do one on the absurd someday. But so this idea of actually not getting what you want, and that's what you want, somehow enjoying the unending pursuit of life, being a way of finding some sort of pleasure. So there you go. That's the trick.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
What else could you ever find joy in other than what is now? Right? Like, you're always seeking this other thing. But even that is happening now. That seeking of the...
But see, this is where I think you and I have we make a good kind of yin and yang. Yeah. And that's your language, not mine. Yeah. I'm not a yin and yang guy. But is that you're going like the pleasure of the now, and I'm saying no, the pleasure of the not now. But you know, that's exactly it. We are the perfect expression.
We must be saying wise things.
Non-dualistic stuff. Yeah.
Because they're opposites.
I love it. I think somehow connected.
Yeah. I agree.
Nice one. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Do you have any places you want to direct people?
No, just if they're interested in finding out more, fire on them a website, and you'll find lots of material there.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks to Peter Rollins for being on this episode of the Liturgist Podcast. My name is Michael Gunger. I've been your host. Thanks so much to the patrons for making this show possible. If you'd like to join the Liturgist community, we'd love to have you part of us. We do these Sunday gatherings, and there's meditations, and there's all sorts of stuff that we've got going on behind the scenes. Just go to theliturgists.com. We'd love to see you around. Thanks, everybody.